When people in the United States talk about race in history, particularly in the 19th century, they're focused entirely on slavery in the United States, the American Civil War. That's not bad things to be. However, they tend to obscure the fact that slavery was a multinational enterprise, that millions of Africans were hauled across the Atlantic to a number of different places, and that the effects of that multinational enterprise are felt to this day. More importantly, slavery did not end all at once. Slaves in the Americas were emancipated over a fairly long period from 1834 through 1889. When Brazil completed its emancipation. So we have a condition, slavery, into which millions of people are cast, and they can be identified as slaves by the color of their skin. And they have been extraordinarily valuable in producing cotton or sugar or rice or whatever it is they're planning to be used for. But here's another reality. No slave wants to be a slave, and all of them long for freedom. And when freedom comes, it has interesting and important effects. And one of those, the abolition of slavery in the British Empire in 1834. That resulted in complete emancipation by 1838, and as a result, in most British colonies, particularly those in the Caribbean where slavery had been the norm, as much separation as possible between the former slaves and their former masters. Not altogether surprising if you consider what slavery was. That also meant that increasingly the former slaves were refusing to work for their quondam masters and instead striking out for themselves as independent peasants. This had an immediate and deleterious effect from the earnings of the master class, an effect exacerbated by the decision in the 1840s to end the Corn Laws, which included protection for the production of sugar. Result was, between not being able to attract workers and being completely caught out by the abolition of the Corn Laws, you were a plantation owner in the Caribbean, you were seeing trouble with a capital T heading towards you, bankruptcy or worse. There was worse back then. So, what do I keep saying? What is the importance of all this? I'm supposed to be talking about political theory and giving you this rigmarole about how the British abolished slavery. It matters. It matters a great deal because it is at the bottom of a dispute going on today between two visions of human order. One in which human beings live together freely and choose democratically their leadership, and one in which human beings are controlled by people who can make an especial claim to be superior. And this worked out in debate over the abolition of slavery in the British West Indies, not in the 1830s when slavery was being abolished, but later on in the 1840s when slavery and the abolition of sugar preferences had a deleterious effect on plantation owners throughout the British West Indies, who naturally, being unwilling to take any responsibility for any of their actions, they blamed it on the former slaves who refused to work for them. Although the former slaves were, as evidence reveals, quite willing to work for pay, providing it was at a level they demanded and paid on time. And they were not willing to work for plantations where payments had become irregular and bankruptcy was creating a vicious cycle in which the plantations went out of business. And some of the plantation land came into the hands of the former slaves as a result. So they saw it as a win. This is not exactly how the planters saw it, and they had friends in Britain who could speak on their behalf, and did. The most important of these was a gentleman named Thomas Carlyle, who is often considered the representative sage of the Victorian era. He lived a long time, from the end of the 18th century all the way down into the 1880s. And he represented a set of views that today would be called extremely conservative. In fact, almost no nothing like. And he was horrified at the state of the planters losing their plantations because they could not compete in an economy in which they had to pay their workers. And he says, it's all the Negroes' fault. In 1849, he writes an article. So it's basically equivalent of a 3-hour long lecture on the subject of slavery and race. And he calls it Occasional Discourse on the Negro Question. When he is challenged, as he was, and reissued it a few years later, he doubled down and changed the word Negro to another word beginning with an N. When I was writing about this, I used the name beginning with an N, and was told, no, you have to call it the Occasional Discourse, not the N-word question, even though that's what Carlyle called it. And one has to appreciate one's enemies as well as one's friends. Carlyle lays out an argument in the Occasional Discourse, which is of peculiar quality. What he does is he argues a priori that black people are intrinsically inferior to white people. In fact, at one point, he seems to suggest that black people aren't that much better than horses. But he doesn't simply want to say nasty things about black people. He wants to propose a way of dealing with the quote-unquote Negro question. And for Carlyle, the best, most just, most reasonable way of dealing with the question of rights for black subjects of the crown was take them all away and return them to slavery. He believed that black people were inherently incapable of maintaining a civilization of their own, that they would function best under the tutelage of white people, and that tutelage had better be made compulsory. Oh, and if the British weren't willing to do that in their Caribbean colonies, then there's always the United States that might want to. Since slavery was very much a living institution in the United States in the 1840s and 1850s. Now, this whole idea is tied in with what we would now call a blood and soil belief, because Carlyle believes that mankind has degenerated tremendously from past ages, and that modern-day Britons are not the equals of the old Saxons who were their forebears. Indeed, he spends a little bit of time talking about old Saxons. And his idea is, evidently, that there is a gradation of ability by race, and that certain people are at the top and certain people inherently at the bottom. And we can color code for identification. Now, Carlyle thinks that slavery is just because black people do not have the nous to be able to figure out things for themselves. Point of view in which he is not joined by any black people. What does he want? He wants slavery restored. He wants it restored because he believes that only in that way can black people be disciplined to produce. He attacks black peasants in the West Indies for growing what he calls pumpkins, and says the West Indies are good for many other things than pumpkins and should be producing them through forced labor. However, a free man or woman with a set of pumpkins is inclined to be able to laugh at those who would want to re-enslave him or her. So there's Carlyle, contemptuous of pumpkins, contemptuous of black people, eager to have all of us return to slavery as soon as possible. And he writes this screed, dozens of pages, and he expands it in 1853 by adding 24 additional paragraphs on the question of slavery in the United States. He is not there for the slaves. He's not there for the idea of human equality. He's there for the idea of human inequality and for belief that some people are naturally to be in charge. And those people, we can tell by their ability to run things, although that is rather tautological. So, who are these people? Well, the superior people are all of them white, and the more superior you are, the more Germanic you seem to be, until you can turn into an old Saxon of some kind from the Dark Ages. But Carlyle didn't have everything his own way. First of all, there were immediate responses to him, both in another journal and in the same journal in which he published the occasional discourse. The first of these accused Carlyle of fostering a monstrous prejudice, which is extremely accurate. The second, which appeared in the same magazine that Carlyle had put the occasional discourse in, was brief. But it eviscerated Carlyle's arguments by saying that freedom was inherently superior, that people who had been slaves had the opportunity now to be free, and if they were exercising their freedom by such things as going on strike for wages, that is to be expected as the actions of free people. Now, it's all well and good reading Mill and reading these things, but when you realize that this is an anti-racist screed from 1850, and that this man is actually saying that your great-grandparents ought to be free and ought to maintain their freedom, you sort of take notice. Because what Mill is arguing is that Carlyle has a limited and cramped vision of political order. That best political order is one in which people are free. And freedom obviously has risks and dangers, but at the same time, huge benefits to the free. So there's John Stuart Mill, 10 years before his major work on liberty and on representative government, taking an anti-racist position. A position so anti-racist that he points out that the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, were a Negro civilization. His words, not mine. Which puts Mill in the category of extremely Afrocentric. I doubt that he actually was, but his belief in freedom was strong, and his belief that all people are entitled to freedom was very strong. So was his idea that people should be judged on their merits and by their ability and by their overall utility to society and to each other. So I tend to go with Mill. Mill correctly diagnosed Carlyle as being racist. He correctly argued that freedom is good for you, risky as it may be. And he correctly argued that Carlyle's nonsense about racial inferiority was nonsense because there was visible countervailing evidence against it. Eric Williams called Thomas Clarkson, the leader of the British anti-slavery movement, one of the few true friends of the Negro. We should add John Stuart Mill to that list. And we should pay attention, I think, to his conceptions of liberty and social justice, which are not too strange for us. But I'll stop there and come back to Mill at some other time.